Michael's Swear is a book. Art. Media. Life and Swear is about. Art. Life and Swear is about. Art. Media.
Life and Swear is about. Art. Media. And culture.
Stand by. Quiet in the studio, please. Cue Norman B. Roll intro. Cue theme music. 3, 2, 1.
This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello, thank you for joining me. I'm Norman B. Coming up in this edition, we're going to talk about animals. Now, cat lovers, you're in for a treat. I'm going to talk with Thomas McNamee, the author of The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions, a marvelous book full of surprising information. Plus, I'll share with you and Thomas a story about Billy, my cross-eyed Siamese, who had a fetish for stealing my underwear. But first, I'm so delighted to welcome to Life Elsewhere an artist, illustrator, and animal rights advocate, Sue Coe.
Thank you.
What a delight to talk to somebody that I've been a fan of, and I'm genuinely a fan of your work, and I'm going to put links up on our site so people can just enjoy your work at their leisure. The Animals Vegan Manifesto. Goodness, this is a daunting work, and I mean that in the nicest possible way. Talk to me about it, Sue.
Well, I'd done 2 or 3 books previously about focusing on the meat industry, dead meat, cruel, and live transport of sheep. They're books that are, you know, I've been in 40 different slaughterhouses drawing from life, ironically.
Ironically, yeah.
They worked. Those books worked, but they didn't work as activist tools well enough. And so I've been with the same publisher pretty much forever, and he suggested a book that was just images, no words, because I tend to think if people have all the information, they'll change. Wrong. No. So this prevented me from putting in all the data of the effect of the meat industry on the environment and the cruelty to animals. And I just had to force myself to do it in pictures and woodcuts, moreover, which is not my strength, let's say. It's like making a potato print.
Yes.
And I think I'm pretty good at drawing after all these years. I'm like an old blues musician that goes from bar to bar, you know, paid like $50 and, you know, after years and years and years, I'm pretty good at it.
I think you were pretty good when you started, but that's okay. Yeah.
Well, thank you. But I'm good at it. But it wasn't working as an activist tool. It wasn't working.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked, but not to the extent I wanted it to work. Because I realized, you know, when Trump was elected, I started to chain smoke. I must have one now.
Oh, my goodness.
I realized I needed something else.
Yes.
I could just be in an art bubble. I had to do something simpler. And it's not simple to be simple, you know that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
So the book is from the animal's viewpoint. I presume to do that. And so it's their manifesto. It's not the human manifesto. It's not how compassionate or cruel we are. It's how the animals can liberate themselves.
Yes. That's what caught my attention about this, Sue, is that you did it from the animal's perspective.
So there's many means they escape, and they're very much refugees, and they have to have the vision of a vegan world. And by vegan world, I'm not referring to a human diet.
No.
A vegan world is a world of nonviolence where they can exist in safety. And so the book is a journey, you know, very much in the form of Mazareel, of how they liberate themselves and find a vegan world. Because I live in a vegan world, I do, here, surrounded by animals. And I wanted to put that in pictures, and I've never done happy animal pictures either.
Right.
You know,
yes.
I just felt like Beatrix Potter doing this. But there's animal joy all around me, and I'd never done it from that viewpoint. But animals have joy, even though they're under a death sentence constantly. They have joy. So I wanted to show that they are living in a vegan world, and I've been vegan for 40 years or maybe more. It is vegan here, and I should show that just once in my life.
Yes.
Show the potential, what we can achieve with animals' agency, because animals have their own agency. They're not property. They belong to themselves, and so it's their story. And the book starts off very dark, and then the animals free themselves with some human help.
With some human help, yes.
Yeah.
We're talking to artist, illustrator Sue Coe. She has produced a new book. It's all illustrations, woodcuts, in fact. It's called The Animals Vegan Manifesto. It's such an amazing piece of work. I want to focus in just for a moment on the fact that you did use woodcuts. There seems something so right about that, because there's sort of this organic thing that you're having to do, and it's touching me as you're talking about animals. And I'm just wondering your thoughts about that, Sue, just the choice of using woodcut.
Well, the fracking corporations took down so many trees, and I used those trees. I had them sliced up, and then I'd ink them over and put paper over the top. And you just need a wooden spoon or a door handle. You don't need anything fancy. You just have the ink, the water-based ink, the wood. And then you see pictures come out. Oh. And the great Japanese woodcut artists, you know, they are the woodcut masters, say that if you can't carve anything better on the wood than what the wood is saying, then don't even touch the wood. Leave it alone. And so I'd look at the wood and see how perfect it is and see if my message is worthy of the wood. So I approached it from that, because these trees were beautiful. They were the homes to bears, birds, squirrels, just cut down for fracking. And I wanted to do something to honor just the wood. And then I just took the wood grain and see what images suggested themselves in the wood grain.
What a wonderful explanation that really is. The Animals Vegan Manifesto, it's called. And I've got a link up on the Life Elsewhere site. We're talking to Sue Coe. You, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, but you, I guess some people would say you're an activist artist. You've done a lot of work over the years, right on the cutting edge, right on the sort of protesting about so many things, from AIDS to animal rights. And this particular book, Sue, it seems to me this one particularly, you're really not holding back. You're just going straight for the gullet, so to speak, on this one. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's very artist therapy. Art has always been therapy for me. It's a way, because people always say, how can you go in a slaughterhouse? Well, whether I go in a slaughterhouse or not, animals are being killed every second, and whether we see it or not. And the therapy for me is I can tell other people, I can show other people. So it's very much like, you know, when you put money in a soda machine and the soda doesn't come out. Well, the first thing you do is sort of kick it a bit, shake it a bit, and then nothing happens. And then you look around for witnesses. This machine just took my money. And then witnesses come along and go, have you tried this? So art is about witnessing to me, and then a collective action to change it. Not suffer in isolation, which is very easy to do, especially today, but to involve other people and share the images and share the content. And because it's figurative art, it opens up a dialogue. So people can look at the images and I can say, well, I saw this, I saw it. And then they can say, well, I'm never eating meat again, which is what people do say to me. And that's been a modest success I think I have had is that of creating so many vegans from the work, you know, thousands, I believe, because it's not photography or film, which can be very alienating. I mean, God bless people. I don't believe in God, but, you know, that get the undercover footage, but it is so tormenting to the soul. People cannot accept it.
Yes.
But if you do it in, you know, drawing slows time down. So I'm drawing in a slaughterhouse or at a feedlot or wherever animals are being exploited, murdered, and it becomes more accessible for people to change and realize they can step away from this violence. Trump cannot stop you from doing that.
Mm.
This is something you can do yourself, by yourself, and have an amazing impact. You can step away from the violence, not do it anymore. And I think art does have that power. It has that power for me, you know, like we talked about when we were students, that, you know, having that feeling of looking at Goya or Rembrandt.
Yes, yes.
You know, and just having, realizing you might be alone with no friends in the world, but that's your friend. That artist is your friend because they have that vision that you have, and or it could be a book too. It could be any culture. That's the beauty of culture, that it can speak out over generations, over hundreds of years, over a thousand years, and still speak to us and give us the tools to create change.
So well put. My guest is Sue Coe. Her book is an illustrated book. It's called The Animals Vegan Manifesto. I want to talk to you, Sue, a little bit about
I'm
your...
glad you like it, Norman.
No, it's just wonderful.
I really am pleased you like this book.
it's amazing. I mean, I often bring my son on to... I mentioned my son on the program. I got a teenage son, and so he's my sort of barometer for things, whether he likes something or whether he doesn't. Now, doesn't necessarily mean that I agree with him, of course, but I always try to sort of run things past him. And I ran this one past him. In fact, on the way to school today, I had my laptop open in the car, and I was showing him images from the Animals Vegan Manifesto, and he said, "Dad, that is awesome." So if a teenage son says it's awesome, so you know that it is.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I want to talk to you about a little bit about your background, and I want to talk to you about animal rights and about being a vegan. And we're going to do that right after this.
You're listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
Diamond in the back, sunroof top, digging the scene with the gasoline.
If you're just joining us, my guest is artist, illustrator, and I guess you would call activist, Sue Coe. A lady whose work I have been just enamored of. Is that a word? Did I just make a word up? For years. And I mean literally years, which means I'm going to now do something which I have to sort of preface this by saying, I hope you don't mind, Sue, but you were born just after the Second World War. So you've been around for a few years, but in your growing up days, you grew up, what, just down the road from a slaughterhouse. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it was a slaughterhouse that was... about a block away, and the back of our little house was the intensive hog farm.
Ah.
So I would hear the hogs screaming all night. And as they were being electrocuted, they electrocute animals in the eye to get them to move forward, especially hogs, into the slaughterhouse. And that was, you know, all around us were the ruins of bombing of World War II.
Yeah, sure.
You know that.
Of course, yeah.
Years for, you know, London to get back. But I would ask my parents, well, how could we have a war? What happened? And I said, well, the animals are being killed now and we don't notice that. And that was just a big revelation. It was a revelation how you can live next door to a concentration camp, death camp, slaughterhouse.
Yes.
And it's so normalized and we're so indifferent. We're just indifferent. And that became my mission then, to stop. It was silly, really, because it's just a kid thinking. And I started doing chalk drawings outside of slaughterhouses. And I went into the slaughterhouse because we were neighbors. So they let me in to draw.
Mm.
And that was the beginning of a very long journey, which it was just the gift of having a mission in the art of something I could fix. And then, of course, I matched up. I then met the great American animal rights philosopher, Tom Regan, who recently died. And he really invented the concept of animals have rights. And then I went to a step further, which was to Gary Francione, who has rights through the abolition approach. So it's the abolition of all animal use. And I read his complete works, and that makes sense. So then I went to become an abolitionist, animal rights activist. And, you know, as an artist, I don't want to just pick up images from the internet. I have to be there. Part of the being there is you slow time down. You get to talk to people and realize these are humans in a slaughterhouse. They're not evil, not bad. I mean, they're as bad as anyone else. That could be us in their shoes. And what do they think?
Mm.
And I always ask, the most recent slaughterhouse I went into was in the United Arab Emirates, which is nearly fully automated. And I was talking to the workers and the staff, and I said, can you imagine a vegan world? And they said, yes. So I said, what's preventing a vegan world? And they thought about that. And they said, culture, because we don't need animals for sustenance. They're not useful to our bodies at all. Animal products aren't. So that was their idea, their view of what they were doing. And so I've learned a lot by being in those situations and understanding somewhat that, you know, the average slaughterhouse worker gets injured after 6 months.
Yes.
Because it's so much a repeat action on their bodies. So they get carpal tunnel. And, you know, and very little safety equipment, I might have to add. But that's not my emphasis, is humans in a slaughterhouse. It's animals in the slaughterhouse. And what I realized quite early on with animals in a slaughterhouse is they want to know what they've done wrong. So an animal, we're animals, and the animal's sense of justice is as acute as our sense of justice.
Yes.
So when they're being pushed and shoved and electrocuted, they make eye contact. And it's, how can I improve my behavior? What did I do wrong to not have this happen to me? And you didn't do anything wrong. And it's impossible for an animal to know that. They can't modify their behavior. They're about to be murdered.
Let me ask you this, Sue. We're talking to Sue Coe. She is an artist. She's an illustrator. And she's certainly an animal rights activist. Let me ask you this, and this is a question which I'm sure you must have been asked a number of times over the year. I'm just going to take the opposing side just for a little moment. And that is, what about hunting? What's your thoughts about that? Is that murder?
Absolutely. Because for your palate pleasure, for your entertainment, palate pleasure, entertainment, no. There's maybe 1% of humans on the planet that aren't getting enough calories from plant-based diet. So no, absolutely not. And actually hunting has gone down. It's dropping. They can't convince kids to do this. And again, I try and do my research with, you know, I meet people and I ask them questions, and I asked, you know, young men, what is it about hunting? And I got a good answer. One young man said, this is the only time I can spend with my father. And my sister has my mother and they spend time at shopping malls.
That's sad, isn't it? I mean, that's a sad comment. Let me just remind people that we're talking to Sue Coe, and I just want to run through some of the books that you've published on this subject. The Ghost of Our Meat, Dead Meat. Of course, we've said The Animal's Vegan Manifesto, Cruel, Bearing Witness to Animal Exploitation. Such a lot of great work. And, of course, lots and lots of other work that you've published over the years. When you talk to people, and you're so good at this, and you're talking about how you feel about animals and about animal exploitation, you do get run into people that argue with you. And I'm wondering about how you explain your own veganism. Is that a word?
Yes, it's a word.
Yeah, how do you explain that to people?
Well, I say that to be vegan is a joy. It's empowering. It leads you to other things you can do. It's one of the few things you can do. And you can do it tonight. You can do it the next meal. It's a joyous exploration. You know, Norman, whether I say to you, I could say to you, well, Norman, I want my partner murdered, let's say, hypothetically. I'm going to give you $300 now to go out and kill him or her.
Yes.
And the person does it.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? I am as guilty.
Yes.
As the person I paid. So when you buy flesh in the neatly packaged, you know, whatever they are in a supermarket, you are as responsible as the person doing your dirty work for you. That is not ethically acceptable.
Let me ask you this about being a vegan. What about fish, about seafood?
Well, we need to stop this right now because, you know, so many animals are getting caught in the nets. Just fish feel pain. They suffer. They sing to each other. They're beings with highly complicated lives. We don't have a right to take their lives. This is destroying the oceans. No oceans, no humans. No, absolutely no. I mean, the most questions I get about this, and I'll tell you, I've had thousands of conversations, are about cheese. This is big. Oh, I hardly eat any meat, but I really like the taste of cheese. How can I give up cheese?
Yes.
Well, you know, if you eat cheese, you are on the top of the chain of cruelty. Absolutely the top. It is not preferable. You're not doing anything. You're actually keeping the system going. So, and there's many nut alternatives you can make at home that will give you that fantastic taste you desire. You know, because I live right here, which is a few half a mile away from cows crying for 48 hours for their calves that have been stolen from them. So they cry and cry, and their calves actually destroy their vocal cords crying back. So the cows are inseminated. They give birth constantly. Cows die very, very young. So when you think of the meat industry, think of babies. It's babies. They don't live any sort of life expectancy. By the age of 4 to 6, the cows are sent to a slaughterhouse. They're all milked out. So the milk for their calves goes to making cheese, or us, the human. We are not designed to eat those products. It'll eat cow's milk. It's insane. It's absolutely insane.
You know, I'm really glad that we've been able to let you voice your opinions here. It's very, very interesting. It's absolutely fascinating. Of course, time is against us, Sue.
Luckily for you, I could really go on and on.
The book we're talking about, but I want you to also check out the rest of Sue's work. We'll have the links up at Life Elsewhere. But the book in question is called The Animal's Vegan Manifesto. It has been an absolute delight talking to you. And as I said right at the very, very beginning, I have been an absolute fan of yours, Sue, for such a long time, and just keep at it, will you? Keep producing this marvelous work of yours. Once again, everybody, the book is called The Animal's Vegan Manifesto. We have been talking to the wonderful Sue Coates. Sue, thank you so much for joining us
thank
at Life
you.
Elsewhere.
Thank you, Norman.
Cat lovers, stand by. Still to come in the program, my conversation with Thomas McNamee, the author of a brilliant new book about cats, and my story of Billy, my cross-eyed Siamese cat who liked to eat his food with my underwear draped over his food bowl. That's right after this.
We love to hear what you have to say. Write to this address, info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
The Inner Life of Cats. And the subtitle is The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. Thomas McNamee is with us. Thomas, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you, Norman. I'm delighted to be here.
I've just got to start with the cover, because there is this remarkable photograph of a cat on the cover. What a gorgeous photograph that is.
It is a great picture. And, you know, everybody asks me, that's my cat. I wish I could say it was.
Yeah, it's not your cat.
I have no idea who that cat is.
Yeah. I realize it probably was a stock photo or it was... Yeah, but anyway, it's just a great cover. So let's get right into it then. And as I said at the beginning, I was very thrilled to be able to talk about this because you mentioned this in your book, at the beginning of your book, because I'm one of those people that I sort of mumble and grumble about. I'm not really a cat person. I really don't like cats, even though I've owned a cat, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But I sort of fall into that category of that I don't like cats very much, except cats always come to me, always, always, always. And you mentioned this, and I want to find out about that.
Sure. I mean, this is it's somewhat speculative, really, but the idea is that particularly with people cats don't know, looking a cat straight in the eye is taken as something of a challenge. It's considered somewhat aggressive. And so the person who doesn't like cats in a room, let's say, cat walks into the room, the non-cat person doesn't usually look at the cat. Cat takes that as the friendly gesture, looking down and away is taken as a modest hello. So the cat walks directly to that person.
Oh, now I understand. Okay, well that explains a lot then, doesn't it? So let's get to the beginning of your book, and you talk about the evidence of something resembling domestication of the modern cat was thought until recently to have been identified in northern China. So when did we really find out about the domestication of cats, and how long have cats been domesticated?
Well, it partly depends on what you mean by domestication, but
yeah.
We know that they've been in company with humans for about 10,000 years. In other words, since the birth of agriculture, people began to store grain, and then cats and rats and mice came to steal it. And the North African wild cat began in North Africa and the Middle East began to hang around hunting. And it turned out that that particular species had an ease around humans. And so they began to hang around the granaries hunting, and the humans thought that was a good deal. And presumably the young cats, kittens, were particularly friendly with humans. And so there began this 10,000 years of association. We don't know when they began to be really pets. And about 5,000 years ago, there is a temple painting in Egypt of a cat with a collar and a leash. Well, was that a sort of god cat? Because Egyptians did come to have a couple of gods that had cat heads.
Yes.
Were those pets? We don't know, really. The real lap cat type, you know, your real house cat, may have developed only just a few hundred years ago. But we do know that the North African wild cat, which exists today in the deserts of North Africa, is the direct ancestor of our cats. That's a subspecies of this larger cat, the Felis silvestris. There are many other subspecies around the globe, and only this one particular subspecies can be tamed.
Now, you go into it in great detail in your book, which is what makes your book, The Inner Life of Cats, so fascinating. There's you you have a great way of telling stories throughout your book and bringing up little sort of little stories within the bigger story. So one thing that I caught up on early in your book, you say, have you ever seen anybody try to pat a cat on the head like a dog? What a great question that is. And that's something which stopped me in my tracks when I thought about that.
Well, they don't like it. Most of what cats like in terms of the way you touch them is an imitation, an emulation, if you will, of how their mothers treated them as kittens.
Ah.
So mother cat licks the kitten's head to smooth its hair. And so your cat generally will like to have you stroke its head. Mother cat never goes bop, bop, bop on top of its head. I learned this a long time ago from the original horse whisperer. When I was living in Montana, we had this guy, Buck Brannaman, come and give us what he called clinics in horsemanship.
Mm.
And he would, people classically walk up to their horse and go bap, bap, bap on the horse's flank. And the horses hate it. They, you know, you've seen a horse
yes.
shiver all over and to sort of shake flies off.
Yes.
And that's what they do when they don't like when somebody touches them. And Buck would show us, look, you need to stroke your horse.
Right.
And then I realized when this cat walked into our lives in Montana that we also began to learn. I mean, the cat will teach you what it likes and doesn't like. Some cats will actually, you know, if you pat them, they might sort of bite you.
Yes. The book is called The Inner Life of Cats. Thomas McNamee is my guest. What a great read this is. You talk in the beginning of your book about a cat that you find, and you relate the story so beautifully about Augusta. Can you just very briefly just talk about Augusta, just the beginnings for my audience? Because I was just riveted by this.
Well, we were living on a ranch in Montana, way out in the middle of nowhere, and it was December, and it was snowing. It had been snowing hard. And this little black kitten found its way down our quarter-mile-long driveway and into a barn and survived the night somehow. Somebody, some person of unimaginable character, had dumped this little kitten in the snow. So that's how we got Augusta.
In Chapter 2, the headline is Becoming a Cat. And then the first line is, and it's a very short sentence, a lot of cats have mental problems. Tom, you got to tell us about that.
Well, that chapter derives largely from a great, great study which was done by a woman named Elaine Karsh back in the 80s, and just before the beginning of the internet. And because of that timing, it's never become widely known. And it just remained sort of buried deep in the scientific literature. And I think it's the most important thing in my book and the most important thing that's been learned about cats in the modern era. Elaine found that kittens need to be handled by humans as early as the age of 2 weeks. And that the way their brains develop, there are these narrow windows of certain forms of mental development such that when they are handled, and by handling she means cuddled and mm-hmm. talked to and held close to the body and so forth, they develop a confidence and a coolness and boldness and just a peacefulness that cats that don't get that treatment don't have.
Right, yes.
And so if kittens are raised that way, you get a remarkably stable and good cat. And unfortunately, you know, the gospel these days with veterinarians and cat raisers of all sorts is that, well, you know, you adopt a kitten at 7 weeks, or you just start to pay attention to kittens at 7 weeks, and the kitten's going to be fine. Well, it's not the case necessarily. I mean, many of them will, some won't. And it's this socialization process. And it, of course, if you start it early, you know, depending when you start it, it can still be fine. But a lot of times people start it too late,
mm-hmm.
and a yes. lot of kittens, cats then, are sort of confused about their relationships with people, or they hear a car horn or a thunderstorm or something like that, and they're scared. And fear is a big factor in a lot, you know, we all know
right.
the term Fraidy cat.
Yes,
right?
yes, yes.
So, you know, fear is a factor in cats' lives. And by starting a cat very, very early, you end up with a cat that's very rarely afraid.
You explain all this so well in your book. I think this is why your book is such a fascinating read, that you really go into the details. And then in chapter four, and you bring this issue up, which I think is so important. It's the question of domestication. All other domestic animals, you say, differ radically from their wild ancestors. But that's not the case in cats. Can you talk about that?
Sure. As I mentioned before, they're descended from the North African wildcat.
Yeah.
Most of our domestic animals are many thousands of years from their wild ancestors.
Yes.
Dogs, for example, at least 100,000 years, maybe much more than that, descended from wolves. Cats are very close to North African wildcats. I mean, if you were able to find a North African wildcat mother with kittens, and you could steal a kitten and take it home and raise it, and it would be pretty much a nice little cat to have. Whereas if you took the kittens from a European wildcat and tried to raise that kitten, it would tear up your furniture, it would be scratching you and yelling and trying to get out of the house all the time. This is a particularly adapted, particular subspecies of this cat that made it right for us. And yet, as domesticated as they are, they retain a lot of their wild ancestors' habits. So when the cat goes around your house rubbing its chin on the corner of the door,
yes,
and of course using the litter box and all these things, those are examples of the territoriality that the wild cat uses to mark off its territory.
Right.
The cat is depositing pheromones, which are signposts to other cats. Other cats can smell them very easily. You can't. I mean, you go up to where the cat rubbed its chin on the doorpost, you can't smell it.
You can't smell it, right?
Other cats can tell, oh, well, that was the female cat. She's probably about 3 years old, and she's she's coming into heat, maybe, and cats communicate with pheromones. And, of course, the litter box is in many ways the center of a cat's life, and that's why keeping a good litter box hygiene, very, very important in keeping cats happy. And that's what wildcats do. They have these middens, which are the center of their territory and also very important in communicating pheromonal messages. And a great many other things that are sort of confusing that cats do are holdovers from their ancestors' habits.
It's fascinating. It's a fascinating book. The title, The Inner Life of Cats. Thomas McNamee is my guest. We're going to continue talking, and I want to, you just touched on something about wild cats, and I want to talk about feral cats, because you go into this in quite detail in your book, and we're going to do that right after this.
This is Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. Let us know what you think of our show. Send your comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas McNamee. His book is just a great read. Even if you sort of pretend that you're not a cat lover, like I sometimes do, even though I've had a cat, we're going to talk about my cat that I had in a little while. The book is called The Inner Life of Cats. Thomas, you talk about feral cats in your book, and I'm a little concerned about feral cats, because I happen to have an office, and in the downstairs floor there is a lady that feeds feral cats, and I have a concern about that. Can you talk to us about feral cats, and about there are lots of people and organizations that have, like me, concerns?
It's a very complicated issue, Norman, and it's if we had an hour, I could talk for the whole hour.
Yes.
There are millions of feral cats in this country. We don't know how many, but possibly as many as 50 million, and the numbers are growing. And they do kill birds, and they kill a lot of birds. in some cases, the bird populations are not harmed by this because the birds just lay more eggs. And,
yeah.
You know, birds die anyway. You know, robins lay 4 eggs. So obviously, they're prepared for the birds to die.
Right.
But there are places where, on islands, for example, or in island-like habitats where feral cats have driven species absolutely to extinction. In New Zealand and Australia, for example, the local birds evolved without four-legged mammalian predators. So feral cats just do terrible harm. In this country, people talk a lot about the harm that feral cats do, but they don't talk so much about the harm that feral cats suffer. The life of a feral cat,
yes,
in the city especially, is miserable. They have diseases. They get run over. Dogs kill them. They get in fights that kill them. A feral kitten has less than a 50% chance of making it to the age of 6 months.
Right.
And there's this great humane program called Trap, Neuter, and Release, which is popularly used to try to reduce the populations of feral cats, and it has had some success at that. But the problem is that people still love to get a mama cat and have some kittens, and then they can't get rid of the kittens.
Exactly.
So they go out at night secretly when they can't give the kittens away, and they dump them in the park.
Yes.
And so the feral cat, and they, of course, those kittens haven't been neutered, have they?
Right.
And so the feral cat population grows and grows and
yes.
grows. And as hard as the people, the great cat lovers, try to reduce the populations, they grow anyway.
Yeah.
And then people like the person outside your window feeds cats. Well, that what does that do? It keeps them going, but there's no, I bet that person doesn't take them to the vet.
That's the problem. That's what I was going to get to, Tom, is that, and I know that this lady means well, and she feeds them copious amounts of food every day, and the population seems to increase every day. But there's also a population of really large raccoons. We my office overlooks a bit of a sort of a green area, a park area,
yeah.
And these raccoons come out of drains or somewhere, and these things are huge. They're just massive things, and they come along and they gobble up the cat food, and I think they sometimes gobble up the cats as well. Yeah,
they attack cats. In fact, my cat right now, Isabel, was attacked by raccoons in precisely that way.
Yes.
Isabel got into a big pile of cat food that was put out by one of these good-hearted but misled cat ladies who puts out giant piles of cat food.
Yes.
Isabel got into it, and she was attacked by a raccoon, almost bit her tail off.
Right. Yes. The book is called The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. Now, I've touched on this a couple of times, Tom, and that is that once upon a time, a few years back now, I bought a cat for my partner at the time because I thought it would be, she'd had a major illness, and I thought she needed something to cheer her up. So we went to a pet store, and I bought a Siamese cat, and we named this cat Billy. Well, Billy the Siamese cat was cross-eyed, as a lot of Siamese cats are. But this cat was, and I don't know, this is what I'm so excited to ask you about. Now, I don't know if this was unusual, but Billy talked a lot. He literally talked. He didn't meow so much as he made sort of almost like dog-like noises. Is that kind of typical for a Siamese cat?
It is, yeah. As you say, as are the crossed eyes, purebred cats often have genetic problems. Now, talking, of course, is not really a problem,
yes.
but crossed eyes are.
Yes.
The cat really can't see very well.
Right.
And unfortunately, as pure breeding goes on, and the Cat Fanciers Association, which is the one that establishes breed standards for cat shows and that kind of thing, as breeding goes on, it becomes inbreeding.
Uh-huh.
And as new breeds have been developed with more and more unique features, as these unique features are introduced into the breeding lines, genetic defects come about as well. And
yes.
They have hip dysplasia or arthritis, they develop arthritis, or they just have all sorts of other defects. And that's why, in general, if you want a new kitten, it's probably best to go to a shelter and get a good old mongrel.
Yes, yes.
Because they're They've got genetic diversity.
Yes.
And, well, and they've got hybrid vigor.
I've got to tell you just a couple more things about this cat, because you talk about this the mental illness of cats and some of their, and I'm sure in writing your book and your experience with cats, that some of them do peculiar things. I don't know if you've heard of this before, but Billy, the cross-eyed Siamese cat, he used to do this. He would go to the drawer where I kept my underwear, and he would manage to open it, and he would take a pair of underwear out of the drawer, and then he would drag it across the floor to the kitchen where his food was set out for him in a food bowl. And he wouldn't eat his food until the underwear was draped across the food bowl. And then he would... Now, I know it's bizarre. It's bizarre, isn't it? But is it that bizarre?
No, actually, I think I know what he was doing. Wild cats, after they've made a kill and they've eaten, will hide the food to keep it away from other animals.
Yes.
So they cache it, in other words, for to protect it. Mountain lions always do this. You know, they'll kill a deer, and a deer is more than a mountain lion can eat in a single meal. And so they'll drag the deer off into the brush, and they'll use those big paws to scratch and scratch and scratch and pull duff and leaves and stuff to cover the deer in the hope that other mountain lions or other carrion feeders won't get at it. So your Siamese, I guess, was trying to hide his or her.
It was a he, yes.
Yeah, so yeah. Trying to hide his food. But going for your underwear, that's pretty much a stretch of the ancestral behavior.
I know, yes. I kind of sort of figured it might be something like that. I just thought maybe the underwear was because it was just an easy thing to drag across the floor. It was small enough or so he could get it into his mouth. But the fact was he was very clever, and cats are really clever at opening things, aren't they?
Maybe it had a little residual smell of you. It may have been a bit of an act of devotion.
Yes, that could be it, which again is sort of... It goes into the area of being very, very weird. Now, you touched...
It does go into this category of weird.
You touched on something about the Siamese cat, but it's also with all cats. I want to talk about their eyes and their eyesight, and we're going to do that right after this.
You're listening to My Dad, Norman B. in Life Elsewhere.
Okay, this time, try it a little faster.
You're listening to My Dad and Norman B. in Life Elsewhere.
My guest is Thomas McNamee. His book is called The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. What a great book this is. It's a terrific read. Even if you're not really fond of cats, you'd learn so much in this book. Now, their eyes... They can see things that we can't see in the dark, but they can't see close up, you say. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes, their eyes are, as you say, they can see in the dark. Their eyes are as big as ours.
Yes.
A little, 10, 12-pound cat has eyes as big as ours, and they have this particular mirror-like retina. We call it the tapetum lucidum. I have all this technical stuff in there that you don't necessarily need to know, but if there's going to be a quiz, that reflects the light back and magnifies, intensifies the light. And that's why if you shine a flashlight or something in a cat's eyes at night, you see that bright gold reflection. And so, yes, they can see extremely well at night. And there's a sacrifice made for that, which is the sacrifice of vision up close. And so, if you give your cat a little treat on the floor, they sort of have to sniff around to find it because they can't actually see it very well. But they're very well adapted to seeing motion. For example, they perceive motion as a series of little stills like a movie.
Right.
And that's how they can so precisely, except very fast, much faster, many more frames per second than a movie. And so that's how they can snatch a hummingbird zooming past in the air. They just grab it like a shortstop, grabbing a line drive.
Now, talk to me about the pupils, because that's something I think fascinates us all, is the shape of their pupils.
Right. Of course, they're not round like ours. Well, they're round when they're wide open, as they are in the dark, and then of course they shut down to the narrow slit in
yes.
bright sunlight, so they have a wide range of ability to adjust to the light.
Right. Yes, but do they see things with? Because I think it's always what we when we're looking at a cat, like the cat on the cover of your book. I'm sort of wondering, are they just seeing sort of a very narrow vision like that, or it's not? It's just that's the way their pupil is made.
Yeah, that's just how it's made.
It's just,
they're
yeah.
just adjusting for
right
pure accuracy of perception.
Yes.
Of light.
So I've got to ask you about this, and you mentioned it in your book. Licenses. Dog have to have licenses. Why not cats?
Yeah. Why not? Because then, for example, when people dump their cats, I think everybody should who has a cat should have an embedded barcode reader in the back of the, just behind the head in the neck. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
And then when your cat gets lost, it, you know, they pick it. Whoever picks it up, it maybe goes to the SPCA or to the local, you know, pet agency. They all have these readers now, and it'll be have your name and address and phone number that you can get in touch. They'll get in touch with you and take your cat back. You won't have to have lost your cat.
And
this could be a form of licensing.
Yes,
and that way people who dump their cats will damn well get them back.
Right. Yes, which leads nicely into a story that you tell us about a cat named Holly. Can you talk about a cat named Holly?
Yes. When it was found, it was lost in South Florida, and made her way, and her people couldn't find her. They looked, couldn't find her, and they went back. I don't remember the cities involved. I think maybe it was in Miami, and then they went back to their home in northern Florida, quite a long way.
Yeah,
and eventually, Holly just turned up. And had found her way through, you know, across expressways and through swamps and backyards, a million backyards, and somehow had found her way back to them.
Now, is that because she used, was that smell? How was that possible?
Oh, she had a chip. She had the
oh, she had a chip. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Right. And she turned up in a backyard near their house, hadn't quite found them, but she was starving to death. She was just about falling down, and the person who found her took her to the vet, and the vet... I guess, you know, fed the cat and for a little while and brought her back to, you know, more or less life, and then took her to the nearest place, I guess, municipal authorities,
right.
Somewhere where they had the right kind of reader. And they, sure enough, and there were her people's name and address, and Holly got taken home.
Fascinating story. The whole book is fascinating. I need to ask you, in doing the research for the book and in putting the book together, because you've got such a lot of detail in here, and as I said earlier on, it really is very readable. Even if you're not really predisposed to cats, The Inner Life of Cats is just a good read. But Tom, when you were putting the book together and as you were collating it and getting to the final stages of it, was there something that sort of made you stop in your tracks, that you discovered about cats that you hadn't known beforehand?
Well, first of all, there was that Elaine Karsh study that I alluded to about the early nourishing of cats, nurturing of cats, I mean to say. And I think also that I came to appreciate much more that with greater the complexity of cats' ability to communicate with us. There was a study done in 1944. Again, an early study that had been largely lost by a woman named Mildred Mulk, who studied her three cats at home for years, listening to the subtle differences of their vocalizations and coordinating those with the behavior that followed them, or in many cases, her behavior that followed the things that her cats said.
Yes.
So her cats were trying to say certain things to her, and she figured out what those things were. And it turned out they had a great deal to say. And she also figured out that all cats can have a great deal to say, but you have to develop it.
Yes.
All these things develop as dialogues between the person and the cat, where the cat has a certain kind of a meow, and you imitate it, you say it back to the cat, and eventually you figure out what the cat's trying to say.
Right.
And the funny thing about this is that as complex and expressive as the language may turn out to be, it might not be the same as the language that develops between your neighbor and her cat.
Right.
Because, you know, you work it out with your own cat.
Yes, so yes.
It's like, you know, different dialects of the same language.
Yeah, which again leads me back to my cat, Billy the cat, the cross-eyed Siamese cat, who talked all the time. He didn't meow so much as he literally made sort of little yelps and barks. I mean, it was the most bizarre thing. And he didn't stop, and he wouldn't shut up. He was very noisy.
Siamese are famous for that.
Yes,
my cat, Isabel, is part Bengal, and she doesn't meow much either. But she goes, eh, eh. That's my name. That's Tom in Bengal.
Right.
So when she greets me in the morning, she says, eh, eh.
Ah.
And then there's eh, which is feed me, and so on. And
yeah.
She has lots of noises that are not regular cat noises at all. She also can meow, but she also has a whole string of Bengal sounds.
Have we discovered, or do we know, and from what you found out in writing your book, do cats like us? Do they like humans?
Absolutely, they do. This is somewhat speculative, but I believe that, first of all, if we go back to the North African wild cat, it was clear that even in their completely wild state, they had a tolerance for being close to humans. And I believe that over time, that tolerance developed into a fondness, and that there was a latent capacity already there in their genes for human companionship, and that over time, that genetic disposition for companionship became a disposition for love. And there's no question that when we love our cat will love us back.
Ah, yes.
And
yes.
You can find books that say, no, they don't love us, it's just a dependency or something like that. But of course, you can take apart human love in the same way. You can deconstruct human love as a mere transaction.
Yes.
If you want to, you know, if you want to be cynical about it, it's just a deal.
Yes.
It's a transaction. But if you take any traditional definition of love, I think cats fit it.
And you talk about love in your book, of course. Thomas McNamee has been our guest. Thomas, it's been a fabulous conversation. Really enjoyed talking with you.
I have too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. You can hear this show again over at iTunes. And make sure you give Life Elsewhere some love while you're there. And do let me know what you think of Life Elsewhere. Send a few words to normanb@lifeelsewhere.co. In the next edition of Life Elsewhere, an interview with up-and-coming British singer-songwriter Leon. Till then, you be good and be well. Most of all, be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.